Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Today's program is all about the French Connection and us. A little later, we'll discuss a movie about a local town with a French name. That's Belleville. But first, we'll talk about the man for whom St. Louis is named, King Louis IX of France. How did it happen that this man, who was born almost exactly 800 years ago, on April 25th, 1214, and the only French king to be canonized, became our city's namesake? We'll find out. Joining me in studio, Thomas Madden, professor of medieval history at St. Louis University and director of the Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies. Elizabeth Westhoff is director of marketing and mission awareness for the Archdiocese of St. Louis. A little later, we'll be talking with Judy Mann, curator of European Art to 1800 at the St. Louis Art Museum. Elizabeth and Thomas, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Dad. It's good to be here.
Interesting subject. I think a lot of people are going to learn a lot they thought they knew but didn't in today's program. Tom, let me start with you. Who was Louis IX?
He was the King of France from 1226 when he came to the throne until his death in 1270. You might think that's a long period of time, 1226 to 1270. He actually came to the throne when he was only 12 years old. His father had died in a crusade, and so he had to grow up very quickly. He became a saint. In fact, he was the only saint, sainted king of France, largely because he led an extremely pious, a very humble life, which is not the kind of thing you usually associate with a king, particularly with the kings of France during the Middle Ages, who tended to be either warlords or very powerful men. Louis also, as most people know, if you see him, you see the statue in Forest Park, he was also a crusader king. He many kings went on crusade, but not many went on two crusades. And he went on one in 1248, and then another one he left in 1268. So he was a very determined and dedicated crusader, and he died on the Second Crusade as well.
It sort of belies the impression that, you know, he was a very pious man and kind of low-key. I mean, these crusades were really something else, weren't they?
Right. But you have to remember, in the Middle Ages, the state of the Holy Land and also of Jerusalem really weighed on everyone's minds, kings and peasants alike, because for them, the state of Jerusalem spoke directly to what God thought of his people. And this was something that was very important to them. During Louis' day, most of the Near East was under Christian control, the areas that are today Syria, Lebanon, Israel. Jerusalem had been under Christian control in 1244, but it had been conquered and then brutally sacked. The Christian population was put to the sword in 1244. By the Khwarezmian Turks and also the Egyptians. And so that it was really that event that caused Louis to begin to think about how it was his turn now to go on crusade. His father, as I said, had died on crusade. His grandfather also had gone on crusade. Crusading in the Middle Ages, particularly among the nobility, was very much a kind of a family affair. He passed it from one generation to another.
Well, he obviously spent a lot of time in that other part of the world. Who was minding the store while he was away?
Yeah, he did spend a great deal of time there. His mother, Blanche of Castile, was an extraordinary woman. She was very well educated, a very pious woman. She very famously said that she would rather see Louis dead at her feet than have him in a state of mortal sin. And she really raised him in a way that he thought a lot about his faith and about his duty to God as a king. And you can see that throughout his life. But she was quite amazing. I mean, if you think about the fact that she had, when her husband died, when Louis was only 12 years old, she at that point had already had 13 children. She had seven still that she was raising. And she also was the regent of France and had to fend off a number of attempts to try to move the child king out of the way. And she was successful in all of those. And then Louis, in his 20s, decides to go on crusade. And she was very upset about that. She did not want him to go. In fact, she got the vow taken off by the Bishop of Paris, and he immediately just took the vow again. He was determined to go. But then she had to be the regent of France throughout the time he was gone. She kept sending letters to him saying, please come back. My health is not well. I need you to come and be king of France. And eventually in 1252, she died while he was still in the Holy Land.
She was no Lady Macbeth.
No, not at all, no.
Right. Elizabeth Westhoff, let me turn to you. What light can you shed on the sainthood part of the Louis IX story?
Well, as Tom just said, we have it to owe to his mother, really. So Blanche has always been a favorite of mine, so I'm glad that you brought her up. I mean, she really was an incredible woman for her time, and the resulting product was Louis. And you know, if you follow his life, and if you read anything about what he did, and again how important it was at the time that the Holy Land was, the Christians were being slaughtered. So, you know, to go in and try to rescue that population and to reclaim some of the historical places that were in existence, and then to just really live his life for his faith. You know, even at the end of his life, his last words to his son are beautiful. If you read those, they are, you know, the last bit of instruction from a very loving father to a son. And it, you know, he reminds him in the letters to surround himself with good, pious men and to, you know, pray every night. And so you have not only this very fatherly man, you have this leader, but you also have this pious, saintly man who, as we've already said, it's sort of an unexpected dichotomy for somebody living at that time and in his role.
What was the canonization process like then? Do we know? Is it different than it would be today?
You know, the Catholic Church, that's the good thing that you can rely on the Catholic Church for. Not much changes as far as sort of its basic tenets and what we do. So for 2,000 years, we've had something that has just grown into what we currently have in 2014. And, you know, at the time of his death, he was already beloved by his men and by his country and those who were following him. And, you know, it was a very quick process. I mean, we've just seen a recent quick canonization with the upcoming canonization of John Paul II. And some people have said, oh, this is a mistake to go this quickly. And others are saying, no, you know, obviously, santo subito, do it now. And in Louis' case, he died from, I believe, I can't remember, typhus or something like that.
Yeah, and typhus.
Yeah, so he died and immediately, as I know Tom knows, he was boiled down so that his skin could be removed and that pieces of him could be placed into reliquaries and sent out. So the sainthood process in his case went rather quickly simply because people already knew what they had while they had it. Again, in the same cases as John Paul II, we see sort of a recent connection to that sort of sainthood process.
No boiling down in more recent cases.
I'll
remind you, it is lunchtime.
Hope you're enjoying this at KWMU.
Sam, were you going to say something?
No, I just echo the fact that it was a very quick process. It was 27 years. They did actually have a formal process of canonization then that was very similar to the one that we have now. In earlier centuries, it tended to be more ad hoc, but this was the full the full operation. So they had the regular miracles that were investigated. There was a fair amount of argument, actually, between Franciscans and Dominicans about how he should be canonized. But the eventual canonization in 1297, no one doubted that that was going to happen.
Right. Okay, let's move ahead 600 years or so and find out why it happened that where we are right now was named after him.
Well, I should preface this by saying no one really knows, except that Pierre Laclede named the settlement after St. Louis. But we have to remember that he and all of the people that he was dealing with, and first, including the first settlers, were all French. This was French territory. And the French would have known St. Louis as well as we know George Washington or Abraham Lincoln. He was a great figure for them. And remember, this was still before the French Revolution. So these were all subjects of the French crown. And so in that respect, I think it was important. My own theory, and it's as good as anyone else's theory, particularly since I'm a medieval historian and this is not my expertise, is that it was kind of a real estate plan. He was at that time at Fort Deschartres in Illinois. They had only just recently discovered that they were going to have to hand over Fort de Chartres to the English because the French had lost the Seven-Year War. And he was trying to get people at Fort de Chartres to move to his new settlement. And so by naming it St. Louis, by naming it a kind of defiantly French name, I think it's possible he was trying to attract some of these French people who had their pride hurt by the fact that they were having to hand over the fort to the English. Of course, what he didn't know was that all of the land that St. Louis was built on had recently been given to the Spanish. But that would work itself out later.
A lot of wheeling and dealing going yes. on in this part yes. of our history. So why don't we call it St. Louis? With apologies to Judy Garland, by the way. But, you know, why don't we call it St. Louis?
I mean, I think you should either do it the French way or the English way. I mean, the
Same
English
reason
way,
we don't say Gravois or yeah. Illinois.
I mean, the English would be St. Louis. The French would be St. Louis. Mm-hmm. So I think you should pick one or the other. I don't think you should mix them.
What did they call it back in the day?
The original French would have called it Saint Louis.
All right. Let's try to connect some dots between the Catholic Church and from this period on, from the time this area was settled, to the present day. How can we do that, Elizabeth Westall?
Well, it's exceedingly easy. If it were not for the French Catholic population who settled Saint Louis, we wouldn't be here mm-hmm. at all. And then with the incoming of the bishops who came to this area, you know, it was a huge, huge Catholic population in this area, again, settled by the Catholics. The bishops who came here, Dubourg and those original bishops of St. Louis, brought with them, requested that tens of thousands of religious come from Europe to come settle this area, primarily just to you know, populate with those who had some skills and to also help with the Indian population that was here at the time and to help with setting up schools and hospitals and orphanages and sick wards and anything you can think of. I mean, the Catholic Church has always come in and set up what society needs where and when it needs it. And so that is precisely what happened in the case of the settlement of St. Louis, to have Dubourg come in and initiate all of that.
So we are really living today with the legacy of that time, obviously.
Oh, absolutely.
You can point to any number of things today that are a direct result of this early involvement.
Absolutely. You can, you know, all of the streets on which we live, you know, you turn a corner and there's another Catholic settler, you know, Melanthi or Laclede or, you know, all of our hospitals, you know, Cardinal Glennon Hospital was originally established as the only archdiocesan hospital in the country. You know, the orphanages, really everything that exists for the most part in the city of St. Louis was established by the Catholic Church. And it had such a huge Catholic population that as it was developing, you know, the sort of liturgical side of things, or the church side of things, you know, the area of St. Louis was referred to as the Rome of the West, and still is today, because of the fact that we produced so many bishops, we produced so many other dioceses were born out of this area. 44, in fact, really? Were born out of the Diocese of St. Louis. And we just produced so many clerics, so many bishops. So on that side of the coin, you know, we produced much of the Catholic Church that is in the Midwest today. But also just from the social aspect of it, we produced much of what is currently in existence with regard to the hospitals and to the social needs of the society that was there at the time. And it was important because, again, with this huge boom in population, St. Louis was very welcoming to the Catholic population. You know, at a time when many communities were saying no Irish, which translated into no Catholics, St. Louis welcomed the Irish, welcomed the Germans, welcomed the Italians. And so since the Catholic Church is a very heavily cultural church, you had this very open, welcoming nature to the location where all these people who couldn't really settle anywhere else were finding a very great place to settle here and where the church was already established.
At one time in the 19th century, there were more immigrants in St. Louis, I'm told, than there were in New York City.
That's right. Yeah. That's absolutely right.
Tom, anything you want to add to that before we take a break?
No, I'm a medieval historian. I don't know anything about it.
So we're out of your area of expertise, are
we? That's right.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a break now. When we come back, we'll tell you about a forthcoming exhibit at the St. Louis Art Museum, which the Art Museum, as you all know, features a very famous statue of you-know-who. We're talking about Louis IX and his influence on the world of his time and also ultimately the influence here in our very own area. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.